Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Health Matters Armistice Show. We are celebrating Armistice Day, the precursor to Veterans Day, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in our first fractional portion. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and a special radio wave to those hardworking geniuses at the MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. My co-medical host, Shelley Irving, she is assessing weather conditions. And
unavoidably detained.
Absolutely. And here to interrupt and barge in, as he always does from the University of Kentucky, the Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, to tell you how to access us on the Internet, as always, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. And you know, for the record, you're glad I'm here, right? These shows are a lot harder to do if you do it by yourself.
All right, we'll wait till next week. I would just say, as I think everyone concedes, I am the star of the show. But occasionally, it is difficult to get the hired
help.
The
star doesn't shine as bright by itself. Unusual. That's unusual to believe.
Turns out I need some assistance. At least the radio station manager thinks that. So I have to bring Shelley and Rick in, and occasionally Shelley has to go to monitor.
Because I'm always giving you content for this show, and I'm always, you know, you don't do any of the research or find any of the material or anything, do you?
So you think WMKY.org?
Well, I'm thinking if you really want me to talk about how to listen to the show, I am going to instruct everybody to go to WMKY.org. That is correct. That is Moorhead State Public Radio's website. It's where you go and get the audio of the show. Now, you don't just type that in and all of a sudden you hear something. You have to actually go into a menu. You have to find Health Matters. You have to go to the Health Matters portion of the website. There you will find our most recent shows. And in each recent show, there is information about the show and a link to listen to the show. We encourage you to go back, listen to the shows over and over and over. If you do a search on iTunes for Health Matters, you will find us. There's a lot of Health Matters shows out there, but you can find us in the podcast. Get us into your podcasting software and have us automatically delivered to your device so that you can listen to us whenever you like. After that, that's enough of the one-way communication. You want to talk back. Go to facebook.com/HMRadioShow. That is our fan page. You can go there and you can leave us messages. You can leave us comments, things that you would like to hear about on the show, possibly a show name or a show topic. Or maybe you just want to know about something that's going on in the news that's health relevant. Or, I mean, let's be honest, you could actually ask something that's not health relevant. We will get on there and mix it up with the fans and the listeners. So certainly take advantage of that. Get Tony a question. Go out there and interact with Health Matters. Again, you can find that place at facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor today is hand washing for the flu season. They have a catchy jingle. Wash, wash, wash your hands using soap and water. Rinse them clean and dry with a towel. Teach your sons and daughters. Now, here's the thing about hand washing. We've really looked at this. Rick and I, and sometimes Jelly, have looked at this very extensively, and we are convinced that the blow dryers that you see in the restrooms are not the best way to take care of your hands. There's two problems with using the dryer. One is it splatters germs all over the restroom.
I mean, they're just a flying.
Yep. Blasted at very high velocity off your hands onto some, or off someone else's hands, I think, onto the various things that you touch in the restroom. And so they really do pollute the entire restroom. They change the, if you want to call it this, the biome of the public restroom when you go and do that. The second thing is the purpose of washing is not so much to use chemicals to kill the germs, but it's rather to remove as much of the material they grow on and the germs themselves from your hands as possible before you eat or before you do some task. And if you do not use the towel to wipe your hands, you're missing out on an opportunity to remove dirt and germs. So again, if you think about with your own dishes or anything else, if you simply spray chemicals on and then you were to use air to blow them dry, you would not get them as clean as if you wiped.
So let me ask you this: if you wash your hands and you use the towel to get some dirt off your hands after you washed your hands, did you really do that good a job of washing your hands?
Well, I think it's the combination of things. You do the best you can, but by the same token, it doesn't hurt to have essentially a second cycle where you're going after those germs again.
So what you're saying is if you're backed into a corner and all you've got is one of those air dryers, you probably ought to wash your hands 30 seconds longer.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know what wiping, what I usually do is I wipe them on my pants. I just do. I put them under the
dryer. So you get the dirt that's left on your hands and put it on your pants.
Well, it's at least I wipe them on something. I mean, I'd rather have tissues or something to wipe them on. But honestly,
I'm enjoying this.
I know you are, because you're sitting here thinking, well, how exactly do you wash your hands? And what are you thinking?
That's
and,
it. You're just not washing your hands anymore.
By yourself. All right. This was September 19, 2019. You may have heard about this briefly, but the Japanese researchers looked at influenza viruses. This was a series of tests from Kyoto Prefectural University of Medicine. Ethanol-based disinfectants, that's the hand sanitizers, they would have to be in contact for at least 4 minutes with a flu virus before they could kill it. 4 minutes with a flu virus. You cannot kill flu viruses with simply just slathering some hand sanitizer on your hands and wiping them clean. 4 minutes.
Yeah, you're tired by then.
Yeah, yeah, you don't do that.
You're supposed to brush your teeth for two, and that is extremely difficult.
After 2 minutes of use, the virus is still active. Now, they can chemically inactivate the virus quicker than that. The problem is there is, and this is gross, but it is true, there's a little bit of mucus that the virus is trapped in. How does the virus get to the doorknob? How does the virus get on the surfaces? Well, someone has the virus in their mucus, and then they get the mucus on the doorknob or the surfaces. So the problem is the hand sanitizer has to cut through that mucus, and that mucus is very protective. In a realistic setting, a sufficient time interval cannot be secured between treatments, and the patient's next treatment is performed immediately after the current patient's treatment. In many cases, they write. So the point is, if you are a hospital worker, you really need to try to get to a sink and really try to get the virus off your hands rather than allowing the hand sanitizer. Now, we'll tell you, and they talk about this, it is very difficult to get to a sink between every patient in a hospital setting, and certainly in an outpatient setting or in your home, it is very difficult to get to a sink and wash your hand every time that you need to do it. The point is, anytime there is a sink, that is instantly the preferred method of cleaning your hands, and we need to not rely on the hand sanitizers to protect us from influenza virus. When the virus was contained in saline, the hand sanitizers work. When it's in mucus, not so much. So once again, during this flu season, if you can get to a sink, get to a sink. If you get to a sink, wash your hands in soap and water and then dry them with a towel if you can do that. That is the optimum way to prevent influenza. Everything else is secondary. Hand sanitizers, better than nothing, but not the preferred way. That's our sponsor, hand washing for the flu season. Now, I want to talk for a minute. This is the Armistice Day show, and so I want to talk about Armistice Day. The 11th hour. The 11th day, the 11th month, back in 1918, the Great War ends. That was World War I. That morning, 5 a.m., Germany, bereft of manpower and supplies, faced with imminent invasion, they signed an armistice agreement with the Allies. The First World War left 9 million soldiers dead, 21 million wounded. Germany, Russia, Austria-Hungary, France, and Great Britain each losing over a million lives. 5 million civilians, and you compare that to the U.S. war in Afghanistan, 2,400 U.S. soldiers dead, 5,000 deaths approximately, give or take, in Iraq, 1 million per country in World War I. We just butchered each other's army. I mean, we ran out of people to fight. And that's, fortunately, combined, the Allies had more men than the German did, and everybody just ran out of soldiers. The first Armistice Day was held 100 years ago, 11th of November, 1919. That's why I thought it's worth bringing it in. 100 years ago Monday, first Armistice Day. South African Sir Percy Fitzpatrick proposed a 2-minute silence, and within weeks it spread across the British Commonwealth and worldwide. So time at 11 a.m. on 11/11, and that will be this upcoming Monday. Take a moment to think about all of those millions of people who have given their lives in battle from all countries, but I know particularly from the U.S.
And yeah, it's a sobering discussion, right? It's a very humbling thing to talk about the you know what we've given as a country collectively. You know, even to some extent, I know this while this focuses on, you know, some of the world wars that goes back, you know, to the date you spoke of. But, you know, even when you start looking at things like the Civil War, right? I mean, there's just so much we've given as a country to make this country what it is today. And it's humbling. The funny thing is, as a member of the armed forces at some point in my life, it's pretty amazing. You know,
I think the disturbing thing, and we may come back to this at the end of the show, but I'm not a medieval expert. I claim no expertise there. But my understanding of early warfare was, you know, there were a bunch of heavily armored men, and they would basically carve through the peasants that lined up against them. And so it was mostly civilian casualties, and you could be a knight, and you were reasonably certain that you probably would not face death in battle. At least you take a lot of people with you. And then we got, especially during our Civil War, the arms became so much more lethal.
Exactly.
And you see that between the mid-1800s and the mid-1900s, we were losing thousands and millions in battle. Now we've sort of taken a step back with drones, autonomous weapons, and so forth, that we're back to killing civilians again.
Right.
As a physician, as a person who respects and protects life, very, very discouraging.
But I think it's also, you know, important to note, though, Tony. I mean, it's not like we just decided to take our military might back to a macro level and just start doing things on a big scale. I think we have become more surgical in how we do it. But I do think the tactics on both sides have changed to the point where, you know, I think when we fought some of these wars, they weren't being fought in the middle of a schoolyard, or they weren't being fought in the middle of a city, you know, in between two, you know, a hospital and a daycare. I think, you know, right. I think that the tactics have kind of changed. And so it does require that kind of surgical nature that, you know, while we may not be superb at, it's an evolving, I don't know, method of, you know, trying to keep the peace. And it's tough, but yeah, this is an important day that often, you know, you don't hear a lot about. So I'm really glad you devoted a show to it. Now, I was going to make a joke and go, you know, at what point did they change the name to Veterans Day? Because Armistice Day is just too hard to say.
That's a good point. I
just want to know when our society dumped the hard word and went with the easier word.
Yeah, you know, and I don't have that in. I did some quick research on it, but I do not have that in my research. But this was the origin of our Veterans Day, and now the concept of honoring military dead now with a special observance on 11/11 at 11 a.m. Is now 100 years old. So. Congratulations, and also our sympathies to those who have lost sons, daughters, loved ones in military combat. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and this is the Health Matters Our Message show. We are remembering.
Celebrating is a tough word there because you honor it.
Yeah.
We're honoring
the people who have given their lives in military combat throughout the wars that our country's been in. And frankly, around the world, we've lost a lot of very good young men and women.
Yeah, it's an ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah. Our sponsor for the second time, hand washing for the flu season. You got to hear it again. Wash, wash, wash your hands using soap and water. Rinse them clean and dry with a towel. Teach your sons and daughters. We are talking about hand washing during flu season. And I pointed out the Japanese research on September 19th of this year indicating that the hand sanitizers, because the virus, we tested them against viruses, and they work. They inactivate viruses. The problem is we did not test them in real-world conditions. The Japanese said, well, what about if the virus is embedded in mucus? And it turns out it takes 4 minutes of cleansing with a hand sanitizer before you are able to inactivate the influenza virus. That is longer than most hand sanitizer, than most people use a hand sanitizer. So we have said, once again, it is a okay second. I keep one in my backpack. My wife keeps one in her purse. We sanitize before we eat. We try to at least do something. It cuts down on bacterial counts. It's not a bad idea, but it is not, and let me make this very clear, it is not an equal substitute for hand washing. If you can get to a sink, and particularly a sink that has hand towels, that is your best option. A sink with a blow dryer is a second best option, and the hand sanitizers are for use when you can't do that. That's our sponsor, is hand washing during flu season. Now, this was an article. This is a little bit complicated, but I wanted to make this point.
But so are we.
Thank you very much. There is a germ called Escherichia coli. See, I can't. That's a tough one. We call it E. coli because we can't say Escherichia. But it lives in people's colons.
Well, we usually can only say it once, but it's after four times of practicing.
Yeah, and if we've been drinking, it's just done. But E. coli, the most common bloodstream pathogen in most places, mainly because it lives in your colon, but it's a fairly short distance to the female bladder, and then it causes urine infections very commonly in women, and it gets into the blood from there. So the question was, you know, we know that we've got these, some of these E. coli's are resistant to antibiotics, and we think that that is because we treat people with too much antibiotics. Your sinuses are congested, take an antibiotic. You get a cough, take an antibiotic. Your ears hurt, take an antibiotic. We have prescribed tons of antibiotics, and we in Kentucky are one of the highest antibiotic prescribing state. We have a lot of smokers. They do get a lot of respiratory symptoms, but for one reason or another, we prescribe a lot of antibiotics. Maybe that's where these resistant germs come from, is we're giving too much antibiotics to people. Now, another theory is, well, maybe they're coming from the cattle farms. You know, they use antibiotics to fatten the cattle and livestock of all types, including chickens, it turns out they grow faster if you feed them antibiotics. So I was always grumping around the clinic. I would say, gee, you know, they're trying to get me not to prescribe antibiotics to these people who are smoking. Meanwhile, we're just feeding them to cattle just to make them fat, and I don't think that's fair. Well, this was an interesting piece of research. It came from the United Kingdom, and they were able to do DNA sequencing, and they said, where are these resistant E. coli coming from? There's a little bit different E. coli in our colons than there is on the cattle farms, on the chicken farms, in the livestock.
You would hope.
Yeah, and so they DNA sequence them. And they said, well, how do we get sick? Are we getting sick from chickens and cattle runoff, or are we getting sick from our own colons? It turns out, according to this DNA sequencing analysis, they looked at six different studies, and they found that the most common source is, in fact, our own colons. We are our own worst enemy. We take that E. coli from our backsides, we transfer it to our front sides, and we've got a bladder infection, a kidney infection, and then we've got germs in the blood.
I hate to say this, Tony, but that sounds gross.
Well, if you...
Just the thought of that sounds kind of gross.
Right. And so the chief way we can avoid that is hand washing. Obviously, after number two, it is critical that you wash your hands. Not sanitizing, wash your hands. So we are back to influenza and other conditions. The best thing to do is wash your hands with soap and water.
So let me ask you this, and I think you're going to say yes. I really do believe you're going to tell me, well, that was dumb. Just be safe. There's a discussion as to if you close the lid and flush, then there are, you know, water particles that don't escape. But if
right.
you leave the lid up, whether the seat's down or not, just the churning of that water will cause droplets or things to aerialize and actually find themselves in your environment.
Let's be more specific. On your toothbrush, this is what I worry about. Yes,
right.
It could.
So the question is lid down. You should not flush your toilet unless the lid is down.
Yes. That is a better way to go. Now, will that prevent diseases? I know that
hand
washing
will prevent
diseases.
But
I don't know if that will prevent diseases or not. But, yes, you are correct. Everything you said is correct.
But if you're going to wash your hands, that's good. If you're going to wash your hands and close the lid when you flush, that's better. If you're going to do, you know, some other tech and then use hand sanitizer, everything can be part of a master plan. It doesn't have to be one thing.
Right.
The more pieces you add to that plan – the better chance you have.
And you keep going. And I'm, you know, of course, we're
now there is some point where you diminish returns.
We love talking about toilets here at Health Matters because well, this is where we grew up.
We're in eighth grade. Let's
right.
be honest.
But going further with that, you know, you have now some of the toilets that have compressed air to more forcibly put flush things down.
Which you would, yeah, but you would think unless it's literally vacuuming it out. Does it still not aerialize some of the...
And I wonder, I actually wonder if it's worse because it's so violent.
Right.
I have not seen any comparison of those toilets. And I have also not seen, this would be fairly easy to do, to see what would happen. I'll look for it, see if there's anything out there. But I have not seen anything come across my desk saying that putting the lid down alters the flora in your bathroom. But I think it does. One thing is clear, I would not have my toothbrush next to the toilet. I think that is that's why do that? I guess is what I would say. You'd be better off to protect your toothbrush. Bathrooms are not terribly clean places. Now you've seen though these infectious disease people. They'll swab the cell phones. They'll look at the kitchen sponges and all that. They have not ever shown here. This is really critical, I think. Even though they can find just boatloads of germs on various household devices, no one has shown that covering, replacing, changing those devices prevents diseases. We have remarkable immune systems. We can live in a germy world. I think it makes sense.
Don't you think, to some extent, we're designed to live in a germy world?
Right. And so when you talk about these germs, realize, you know, I mean, they had open toilets 100 years ago. People survived this sort of stuff. But what's the optimum? You know,
it was hard to flush an outhouse.
It's hard to flush an outhouse. On the other hand, kids played in dirt. And we know that kids who play in dirt have a stronger immune system. So how much do you do to test your immune system and where do you stop? I think hand washing has been shown to prevent transmission of diseases. It makes perfect sense. Beyond that, how much do we do? How do we engineer our bathrooms to help us? And would it make any difference if we drop the lid every time, change the flushing system, did all those things? Is that going to make any difference in our health? I've never seen anything on that.
You know, one of our previous homes we lived in had the toilet itself was in its own little small room with a door. So that now in the more modern era, you could have that same exact thing and electronically, you know, do a smart flush, right? So it only flushes when somebody's not in the room.
I like it. You know, Japanese do that sort of
stuff. They get kind of techie. The whole northern European, you know, the whole Norway and Sweden, they are very high tech as well. And I think it's slowly creeping into the lives of Americans. We're starting to see a whole lot of smart products, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day about putting in 6-inch vent ducts in their house that have fans in them, and the fans are completely controlled through smart motors and smart controls. So you can actually, you know, if your office doesn't always say the same temperature as the rest of the house, well, you know, you can fire on a fan and cause a little extra heat to get in there, a little extra air conditioning. I mean, it's pretty cool some of the things they're doing with these smart home technologies.
Now, you went to the Consumer Electronics Show. You do every year.
I will. I'll be going again this year.
Do they have a bathroom section? They have a home section?
I don't know. You know, I probably will try to find something to see what kind of smart technologies they're putting in the bathrooms today. But most of the time, it's just superficial stuff, right? It's lights. It's, you know, heat, that sort of things. It's environmentals. But it would be interesting to see.
Stay tuned, but don't hold your breath because the Consumer Electronics Show is...
After Christmas.
Right. So we got a little bit of time here while Rick is trying to figure it out. But Rick is now a man with a purpose. Granted, he's supposed to go and protect UK from whatever the students are going to bring on campus. But by the same
get ahead of what they're bringing on campus. I kind of get a feel for what's the next great thing and, you know, kind of and try to gauge, you know, are the TVs going to be, you know, 27K or are they going to be, you know... Are they going to be, you know, are the wearables moving to Wi-Fi? Because, you know, for a long time, wearables were a real concern, but they didn't use Wi-Fi. They didn't use, you know, they were just kind of Bluetooth to your device. Well, now they actually have embedded Wi-Fi sources. And so now you start to think about it, you don't realize it if you're wearing certain smartwatches and your phone and your tablet or laptop, you know, you're now carrying 3, maybe sometimes 4 devices on your person, you know. I've seen now they make shirts that have heating elements in them that can be smart.
Internet shirts.
All kinds of stuff. Jackets now have heating elements built into them. And again, all this stuff is Wi-Fi smart controlled, and it's really getting crazy watching the Wi-Fi system grow.
And so Rick will soon be controlling your jackets and probably your underpants.
I'll just know what you're doing. That's all.
Do not even think about that. It's going to creep you out. But let's stay with the tag for a minute, because I did have, this was the October 24th New England Journal of Medicine, and I think this is worth looking at. This was Mayo Clinic actually wrote this. And when you get an MRI scan of your brain, they lay you down in a scanner, and they create basically a 3D representation of your brain, but also of your skull and your ears and your nose and your face. Now, the Mayo Clinic, the question they had is, well, do you think we could take an MRI scan, we could run it through facial recognition software, could we figure out whose scan it is? And they were looking from a privacy standpoint, could they figure out from your MRI scan who you were if they got their hands on it? So they took 84 volunteers, ages 34 to 89, and they photographed the person's face from five slightly different angles, and they fed that into the facial recognition stuff. Everybody had
Stuff.
Yeah.
You use a highly technical term there.
And I apologize because I don't know what the stuff was. It was a software.
So something like what you do to unlock your Windows phone or something. Yep. So like if Apple has a Face ID where it looks at your face and says, hey, you're who you say you are.
Right.
Okay.
Then they used an automated system to reconstruct a three-dimensional computer model of the face from the MRI scan. So they had, and they created photographs of that, two-dimensional photographs. They make a picture of your reconstructed face from your MRI scan.
Sure.
This is all the, put those slices
gotcha.
Together. So then that was, again, they had 84 volunteers. They had 84 MRI-derived faces that they put into the facial recognition stuff.
System.
Stuff. I'm going to keep using stuff because I know it bothers you.
It does. Because, you know, the devil's always in the details, Tony.
I know. That's why we don't go in the details. Why do you want to go there? The devil's there.
Because I'm held to a technical standard on this show and not just a funny standard.
That makes no sense.
You, on the other hand, aren't held to these standards.
I'm not going into the devil. That's not a good career path for me. Back to the research. For 70 of the 84 participants, the software chose the correct MRI scan as the most likely match for the photos.
Of course.
70 out of 84. That's 83%. And it was in the top five choices for 80 out of 84. So they had a few faces they couldn't identify. They said this was pretty primitive software. This was just a, hey, can we do this
sure.
sort of thing.
Right. It's
so
tough.
If you decided, if you wanted to go back and you had MRI scans and you wanted to identify the people, the scary thing is, you know, we're doing this in medicine, we collect all sorts of information that we can run backwards from biopsies. They have your DNA, you know, blood samples, things like that. We can work backwards from a lot of different parts and figure out who you are. And now MRI scans, it turns out we can figure out who you are from the MRI scans.
Right. The good news here, Tony, there's good news here because you've just freaked out a lot of our listeners.
I know. I like it.
Right. But Don't be fooled by Tony's stuff. So it's one thing to have facial recognition. It's another thing that when facial recognition includes iris scans. There are other things you can do that makes your face not your face, right? So eyes don't get caught. I guarantee you they can't do the iris. They can't
not
in the MRI. They can't make an iris.
They can't do that. Now, what they did say is you could blur the face on an MRI scan. Nobody does it because why would you do that? And it might mess up the interpretation of if you blur the face, maybe you might blur a little bit of the brain or something like that, and you couldn't get a good reading. So they just don't do it. But it is possible to make it so they couldn't. I think just for me in general, the amount of privacy you give up to get medical care, well, for that matter, to sign up for an app or something is frightening. You know?
Well, but I mean, the thing is in the case of your medical care, it's not like they don't have a record there that's got your social, your address, your insurance cards, your, you know, firstborn, your, you know, I mean, it's not like they don't, I mean, that record has, that MRI is part of, there's so much identifiable information in there. That's why we protect it with things like HIPAA, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so is your MRI protected? Well, it already was because it has your name down in the corner, right? So the thing itself was probably already protected data. It is kind of cool that you can create an image that's good enough to take essentially a picture of, and that will kind of fool some simple camera systems.
Yeah. if I am CSI or one of the whatever these crime shows are, I'm all over this. We're gonna identify the perp. We're gonna identify the perp.
Sure.
We know the Vic. We need the perp. We're gonna identify the perp from the MRI scan. That's in my next episode.
Well, I mean, if you ever get that chance. But you know you won't. Sorry.
No, sorry about that. So anyway,
the thing is this gives me one opportunity to say a term that everybody needs to hear. You don't mind. Most people don't mind when it's their bank account. They'll go through a two-factor or a multi-factor authorization process, right?
Right.
I am so and so. Here's my name. Here's my password. Oh, and here's the special code, or here's where I was born, or here's my security question that I set up. I know the answer to that. That is a separate factor of authentication. So we love two or multiple factor authentication. Facial recognition is a single factor. So again, from a security standpoint, if you're going to, don't make sure that if you have sensitive things, do multiple factors, two factors, right? Send me a text message. So they've had to validate my phone on file, along with my password, right?
All right, I like it.
If you do facial recognition, I should have to put in my password, and it should recognize me.
I mean, password, and then you send your MRI scan to your phone, right?
No.
And then you use your fingerprint.
Well, I'm just saying, if you're worried about somebody taking your MRI and hacking into your bank account, you know.
I love that.
You have to make sure.
This is an even better show than getting the perp by the MRI.
Just make sure there are multiple factors that you use.
That we're discussing this. I've got the whole plot.
Cybersecurity is confusing. People think that multi-factor thing is annoying, but it's very important. It's the only way. What do they say? What's easier to break into, a house that the door is locked or a house that the door is not locked?
Right.
Well, of course, if you put up minor barriers, it makes it more protected. Well, multi-factor, because other people won't do the multi-factor, their accounts become much easier to get to, thus yours becomes safer because they're always going to go to the path of least resistance. So, the thing is you don't necessarily have to stay ahead of the hacker. You just got to stay ahead of your neighbor.
Right? The old joke. I don't have to outrun the tiger. I just got to outrun you.
But the thing is, you really do. I mean, it's really important. All seriousness, multiple factor authentication is extremely important in the cyber world we live in. Right? You have to if you have sensitive data. And let's be honest, some things like who would have thought that a magazine subscription would be that important? Well, it's not unless you put your card on file to pay the bill. Now, all of a sudden, they've got credit card numbers available. So if you're going to do that, you want to have many factors of security. Think about that while you're on break.
We're going to take a break, and you should too. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Health Matters Our Mrs. Show. Our sponsor for the final time, and we will try to move rapidly on this
one.
No,
we won't. We're going to take 4 minutes, just like
hand washing for the flu season. Wash your hands using soap and water. Rinse them clean and dry with a towel. Teach your sons and daughters. That's right. Hand washing during the flu season, because hand washing is the most effective way to protect yourself from those respiratory infections, influenza viruses, and those nasty E. coli germs that turn out they are coming from inside you, not from the stockyards, not from the chicken you eat, not environment. We need to be spending more time washing our hands. Hand sanitizers have their place when you can't get to a sink, but if there's a sink nearby, by all means, use it. That's our sponsor, hand washing for the flu season. I wanted to get to this one because I put this on the day we recorded it. I put this on our Facebook page, and instantly I got some questions and feedback on this. I think this is important. This was the October 22nd European Society of Cardiology. I don't routinely read this, but this summary came over and caught my attention. I'm going to read some of this. This is from the Hygieia Chronotherapy Trial. Now, chronotherapy is the idea that pills do not work the same in the morning as they do in the evening. If we can sync the pills with your circadian rhythms, we can do a better job treating your medicines, treating your conditions. As a matter of fact, most people don't know this. People, I ask my patients to say, when is your blood pressure the highest? What time of day is your blood pressure the highest? And most of them will say, well, you know, if I had a person like Rick, my blood pressure would be higher later in the day because I would just get more and more exasperated with my social and professional dealings. I mean, you can see that, Rick. You know you do that to people.
You know, the thing is, I would say, let's solve this riddle. Let's go out and buy a Fitbit and let's track it.
Hold that thought because we're going to get
back
to that.
No, I'm not going to hold it. I'll forget it.
Hold the thought.
I'll forget it.
I'll write it down for you. Hold that thought. So, it turns out your blood pressure actually is usually the highest first thing in the morning.
Of course, because I don't want to get up.
Right, exactly. Your body has to wash your entire system with hormones to get you out of bed.
And some of us more than others.
Yeah, and so the blood pressure tends to be highest first thing in the morning. So their question with this Hygieia Chronotherapy Trial, European Heart Journal, they ask, well, you know, what if we had the medicine peaking at the same time that the blood pressure hormones peak? They took 19,084 patients. This is a big, big study. It was done in Spain at a lot of primary care clinics in Spain. And they randomized 19,000 and changed people to take their blood pressure medicines either when they woke up in the morning or right before they went to bed. They followed them for 6 years average. 19,000 people, 6 years. This was a incredible blood pressure treatment trial. Now, here's the thing. Rick was talking about a Fitbit. How did they measure the blood pressure? They checked ambulatory blood pressure over 48 hours. Repeated readings continuously over 48 hours. No one's ever done that. I mean, we'll have office readings, we'll have averages of readings, we'll have two readings so many minutes apart. We might check it overnight, but nobody's ever done that 48 hours. Professor Ramon Hermida, and I'm sure I butchered that name, University of Vigo in Spain, patients who took their medications at bedtime had half the risk of stroke, a 45% reduction in their risk of dying of heart attacks, stroke, or heart failure. They adjusted their analysis. They wanted to figure out, well, what about age, sex, whether you have diabetes, kidney disease, smoking, all those things. And still, even with those adjustments, still, the overall risk of heart attack, 44%. The risk of having heart bypass surgery, 40% reduced. Risk of heart failure, 40% reduced. The risk of stroke, 49% reduced. So they mentioned that's an unusual way to measure the blood pressure. But basically, we have a mechanism whereby taking blood pressure medicines at night might be a good thing to do. We now have a 6-year, 20,000-person randomized trial saying taking blood pressure medicines at night is a good thing to do. Now, right away, I get a feedback from one of our great listeners, Carolyn, who was up way too early this morning, I will point out. And she said, well, should I go ahead and switch my blood pressure medicines over to taking them at night? And I said, well, the experts have been a little slow to respond to this. You know, usually there's somebody saying, we need more. You can't say we need more research. 20,000 people, come on. You're not going to get more research than that, 6 years. But there's some things about it you got to think about. We've already gone down this path before. The cardiologist had a trial called the SPRINT trial, and they would put you in a room when you came into their office, and they would put on an automatic cuff. And it would get three separate readings. You were seated in a chair with your arms and your legs supported and your back supported. Nobody talked to you. They allowed you to calm down after walking in the office. They got three separate readings with nobody talking to you. They averaged those, and that was your blood pressure. And so they proved, or they showed, that if they can get your blood pressure under 120, you have better outcomes. One of the criticisms of that trial is if you walk into most doctors' offices, they're not going to seat you in a room with nobody in it with an automatic blood pressure cuff. They're going to chat you up. You may or not have your back supported, your arm supported. There's a lot of different ways we measure blood pressure. The problem is, if we're looking at this trial, if I'm not checking your blood pressure at night with that 48-hour straight monitor once a year, I'm not doing what they did. So the question is, could we check a daytime blood pressure reading and take the blood pressure medicines at night based on your daytime reading, and nobody's done that. So the more I thought about this trial, I thought, look at that SPRINT trial. That caused a lot of dissension among physicians about whether or not you could compare their results to results in an ordinary doctor's office that didn't have the automatic blood pressure machine in the quiet room. And I think in the same way, we don't have the 48-hour nighttime, and so even though it is theoretically that's a good idea, now we got to go back and say, well, what happens if we just get office readings or you walk in with your Fitbit or whatever? How are we going to adjust these medicines? Because we need to know how low your blood pressure gets at night before you start that rise at dawn to wake you up.
Well, the other thing, too, is I think, you know, is there a way to simulate blood pressure with other things, right? Because, like, today the modern Fitbits and stuff will only do heart rate, right? They'll do heart rate, pulse. You know, so they won't actually tell you what your blood pressure is. You know, they're not actually looking at that. So I'm not sure how we get that, but I'm sure there has to be a way.
Well, I've
especially
already,
since how you wear them around your wrist and the risk, you know, they could actually inflate something or do they could, there has to be a way to do something.
Yeah, I mean, the blood pressure is simply the top number is when you have a pulse and the bottom number is in between pulses. So basically anything that sits near a pulse ought to be able to make some type of a, as you said, some type of a substitute measurement. We don't have that yet. We've not proved that reliability, so we've got a ways to go. My feeling, and we'll talk about this actually next week, but my feeling is that we are going to wind up using these devices, these wearable medical devices. They are going to be the answer to a lot of things. I've already asked my patients with atrial fibrillation, that common irregular heartbeat that you hear about on TV. I've told them, for most of them, I think it would be a good idea to monitor your pulse so that you do not get overtreated if you happen to show up in the doctor's office with a faster heartbeat. I think the other thing is, like you said, could we have a substitute? If the Fitbit showed that your heart rate suddenly jumped and then suddenly went back down, I would think, well, maybe you had a run of atrial fibrillation. I can't prove it, but at least if we were thinking about a heart rhythm disturbance, a sudden change in rate might give us a clue that you do have you had an episode.
Right.
And I think the idea of right now, if you go to a cardiologist's office, they may run a 24-hour heart monitor, and they're going to charge you a ton of money.
Well, they're going to charge somebody.
Yeah. For that amount of money, I think we could all be monitoring our heart rate anyway. We could monitor it very efficiently for pretty much years rather than just 24 hours. So I sense there's a big change here in how we're going to monitor. Our problem right now is people are looking at different ways of measuring blood pressure, and I don't know that you can take one system of measurement and then apply it to a different system of measurement. So after I thought about it from this morning, and Carolyn, I apologize, I may not have made this clear, I understand why the experts have been slow on this, because we got burned, I think, with that SPRINT trial about trying to extrapolate from one method of blood pressure measurement to another. So I'm not ready to say, even though the results look terrific, I don't know how to titrate blood pressure medicines taking them at night.
Well, and let's be honest. I mean, when you're sitting there sleeping, your blood pressure is probably going to be as normal or as low as possible that day. The minute you get up and start walking around, everything has to get back into sequence. I mean, there's no question that your blood pressure is going to go up during the day, right? So the question is it slightly higher in the morning? Is it slightly higher at lunch? Does stress make it go up at 2? You know, and to some extent, that's going to be a lot in the morning when you first wake up. And then it may vary from person to person. I mean, the guy running the jackhammer, it may go up at 3 when he turns the jackhammer on.
Or you may have to work with Rick. I mean, there are a lot of variables that would affect your blood pressure.
I'm saying, you know, the key is here's what I would say is we continue to move towards this path of wearables, right? And maybe the wearable today is a watch. Maybe tomorrow it's a small pack you wear on your side. You know, maybe in 10 years it's back to watch size again. You know, who knows exactly what the development of that's going to be? But if you said, and I'm not trying to insult physicians, so don't take this as an insult, but if I had the opportunity, Tony, for you, barring any personality problems that you and I might have, if you could walk next to me every day, all day, and just watch me and see, Rick, you probably need to calm down. Rick, your blood pressure is going up. Rick, what are you doing? I think most people would say, let's bring that on. I'd love to have my own personal physician. Well, in a sense, that's what these wearables are. Now, again, they don't bring the intellect and the education and experience, but what they do is they can find anomalies. They can sense things when things aren't normal. And that's the beauty of it, is that's what you want to know. And so if you have the opportunity to walk with a physician at your side every day, you're going to do that.
Well, that was an
so
ethics.
Why would you not?
That was an ethics discussion when I was actually in medical school. At that time, Jimmy Carter was president. I'll just tell you that. I mean, it was a long time ago. Jimmy Carter was president. Jimmy Carter would go jogging every day with his cardiologist. And so they were talking
great
about,
idea, by
yeah,
the way.
What healthcare system?
He's 95 now.
Yeah. That's it. What healthcare system are we looking for? Are we looking for a healthcare system where everyone can go jogging with their cardiologist? It was kind of a symbol of wretched excess. But if you could electronically jog with your cardiologist, as you said, that might be a good use of these wearables. The future's wide open on these things. I'm really excited about
absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. I mean, but the thing is, you know, to some extent some people are very open-minded, some people are very closed-minded, and most people are just, well, they can take it in moderation, right? I mean, that's kind of, I guess, what to be expected. The idea of having one of these physicians on your side, or at least, you know, some form of medical, you know, watcher, that's awesome. And you just try to put it in context.
I think we will look, I think, further at taking blood pressure medicines at nighttime because it makes sense. I'm not ready to dose my patients right now. I don't know how to measure the blood pressure if the medicine's dosed at nighttime. It's just something we've never done. Next up, October 15th, Amazon. This one, I've got a very brief comment on this one. Rick, you can talk as much as you want to, but this—
I normally do.
Amazon, Wall Street Journal on October 15th, they're going to control their healthcare spending by paying to send employees to California to receive cancer care. Seattle-based Amazon will cover travel expenses for employees diagnosed with cancer to see the physicians at the City of Hope Cancer Center in Duarte, California. More than 380,000 of Amazon's workers and families are eligible for this benefit, which is fine. You know, we've seen this before. Corporate America now is trying to limit their health care costs by contracting with specific groups and so forth. I think the thing that bothered me was this is Danae Sparman, their director of global benefits, talking to the Wall Street Journal. Instead of waiting for patients to get the wrong care first, then reaching out to an expert, this model is designed so the patient has access to expertise as early as possible to help ensure that the correct care is delivered first. So what she is saying, basically, is if you're not going to the City of Hope for your cancer care, you're getting the wrong care, which is an interesting thing. Now, the City of Hope is a very good cancer center in California. It's ranked 11th best in the United States.
But those other 10 in front of them probably didn't like that too much.
That was my first thought. It's like, why are you sending people to the 11th best? I think what it is, you know, they have a contract with
them.
It's
a relationship.
Yeah, it's a relationship, and they do that. But to say that, you know, if you don't go to this center, you're wrong, I think that implication. And this happens over and over again. In terms of outcomes, a lot of these cancer centers, they do well because they're going to get wealthier patients and people who are more involved in their care. But as she said, the wrong and there are there is evidence that sometimes people are misdiagnosed with cancer. But I wasn't sure that this was necessarily the way to solve that. But Amazon's doing it. We'll talk next week more about it. Walmart is directing their employees as well to certain imaging centers and so forth. Corporate America looks at this mess of a healthcare system we've got, and they are acting. They are, at this point, some of the more forward-thinking corporations are starting to say, look, we cannot just send people to any physician, any medical facility. We're going to start picking and choosing because the quality here is just not there.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting pretty amazing. And I think, you know, as unemployment continues to decline and people start getting jobs, I think the job marketplace becomes far more competitive. And so now all of a sudden employers got to have good plans. They got to have good, you know, services. And so it causes them to look in different places or do it different ways. I just think it's kind of cool. I mean, you know, you're going to see some improvement come right out of corporate America.
It is changing. Can you get us off the air, Rick?
Sure thing. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Shamari Mosley, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org. or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember these words delivered by General Omar Bradley on Armistice Day in 1948.
It is no longer possible to shield ourselves with arms alone against the ordeal of attack. For modern war visits destruction on the victor and the vanquished alike. Our only complete assurance of surviving World War III is to halt it before it starts.
Armed forces can wage wars, but they cannot make peace. For there is a wide chasm between war and peace, a chasm that can only be bridged by goodwill, discussion, compromise, and agreement. Disillusionment is always the enemy of peace, and today, as after World War I, disillusionment can come from expecting too much, too easily, too soon. In our impatience, we must never forget that fundamental differences have divided this world. They allow no swift, no cheap, no easy solutions.
The world has achieved brilliance without wisdom, power without conscience. Ours is a world of nuclear giants and ethical infants. We know more about war than we know about peace, more about killing than we know about living.
Democracy can withstand ideological attacks if democracy will provide earnestly and liberally for the welfare of its people. To defend democracy against attack, men must value freedom. And to value freedom, they must benefit by it in happier and more secure lives for their wives and for their children.
Throughout this period of tension in which we live, the American people must demonstrate conclusively to all other peoples of the world that democracy not only guarantees man's human freedom, but that it guarantees his economic dignity and progress as well.
To practice freedom and make it work, we must cherish the individual. We must provide him with the opportunities for reward and impress upon him the responsibilities a free man bears to the society in which he lives. We at Health Matters bring you this reminder from General Omar Bradley in 1948, which also rings true today. Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. We must learn the lessons from history and dedicate ourselves to avoid repeating them. On Monday, and every day, let us remember the sacrifices of our veterans and chart a course where that sacrifice is no longer required.